This is Main Street on Prairie Public, a place for good conversation. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, history is the past, but that doesn't mean it can't change, especially when it comes to our perception of history. Tom Ezern reflects on the late historian Elwin Robinson, whose life is featured in a digital exhibit from the University of North Dakota. But first, in winter, we might not be thinking about pest control, but spring is coming and bringing with it nicer weather and maybe some bugs and some rodents. Carrie Warburg Block built a career out of managing pests, but her aim was not to kill them, but to keep them out of human space. The Bismarck State College alumna started the company Earthkind. I spoke with her last week about being a female entrepreneur in the bug business. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, they have this great expression that necessity is the mother of invention. I want to talk about that first necessity that came to you that brought on this series of inventions that you now work with, that you now share across the various different stores where they're available.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, in my case, it was quite an alarming experience. I had a mouse run up my bare leg in a grain truck. I was wearing shorts. You can imagine how this feels. It kept running, literally freaked me out. I pretty much stopped dead in my tracks in that truck and did the first thing that came to my mind, which was grab a bottle of perfume out of my purse, and I started squirting it around. And like it was raid or something, and the mice went running off. And you might ask why I would have perfume in a grain truck. Well, it was actually my first date with a farmer in Newtown, North Dakota, on the farm way out in the country. And I was selling perfume at the time. I was working at a cosmetic counter at Herberger's, and I'd go home every day with those terrible headaches from all the perfumes. And I didn't actually wear them myself, but I'd win them. And so I had a bottle with me, and I thought, hey, I'll put this to good use. And I did put it to good use. So all the perfume bottles I had after that point went to keeping mice out of our grain trucks.
Well, nothing says endlessly practical like a small-town farm girl. I mean, you have to be ready for all of these situations, whether you're growing up on the farm or knowing you're going to have to visit one all the time.
Well, I found out shortly after I got married, I asked around, and most of the girls that married farmers weren't from the country. They were city girls, so.
they had a learning curve.
Yes.
But, you know, people have these moments, though, where that might work in a pinch, and, okay, I'm going to spray a rodent that's crawling on me with the nearest available thing. That's a reflex. That's an instinct, basically. But it takes something special. There's this next level to sort of recognize the potential in that and to turn that then into a business. Were you always sort of that inventor type or business-minded even?
I was always pretty entrepreneurial, so I fall into the school. I'm kind of halfway in between because part of it is nature and part of it is nurture. And I say that because when I was five, I had my first lemonade stand. I did it a little different. We lived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, in a large apartment building, hundreds of people coming and going. And there was a little kid out there selling lemonade for, I can't even remember, like 5 cents and a little paper cup. And I was like, hey, Mom, I have this idea. I would like to make lemonade and sell it to the moms and dads, because I think I can get a dollar and I want to put it in a nice glass. I don't want to use, you know, plastic and paper. And I want real lemons. And it worked. But nowadays they have signs, no soliciting, right?
Yeah.
And I went, I sold beads and I'd sit in the little stairway and I'd make beaded necklaces and sell those. And I was always thinking of some way to generate money. When I was, we were living in Minneapolis area. I was about in junior high, and I got a paper route, and I decided I liked collecting better than I liked delivering, and the other kids liked delivering better than collecting. So I got like six kids together to do the delivering, and then I did all the collecting. So I turned it into like a distribution. So I thought of it a little bit differently, you know. they say do what you're good at if you want to succeed, but it really isn't that easy. And taking it back to the germ of an idea where most inventions come from, and sadly, very few of those actually make it to market and get commercialized. But these inventions are, any way that somebody can solve a problem in a new and a novel way that either saves time or saves money or creates something better in some way, there's really something to it. And my idea, I had neighbors that said to me, oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Nobody's going to buy that because, you can buy a poison for $3. Why would people pay $14 for your little bag of sachet stuff that's going to keep the mice out? And it really challenged me to think and do the research. And I cried a couple times, probably more than a couple times. And I was like, maybe this is stupid. Maybe I don't have something here. And I kept thinking, well, there must be something wrong with it, more on the negative side, ruling out everything. And it kept working. And I kept doing my research and I refined it. And there was a market, but the turning moment for me was when I did the research and to see what the market size really was. I knew there was 2 million farmers out there that could probably use this product and would probably buy it. And I was like, 2 million customers, I think I can do pretty well with that. But I didn't even realize how much bigger and broader the market was at that time, like it is today. We're in, with our first product, Fresh Cab, we're in close to 35,000 retailers now. Back in the beginning, it was just, a few. I was selling it to the implement dealerships. There's 125 million households today. And the market is still right now, 90% of it is all poison and kill products. It was 98% when I started just 10 years ago. So we've obviously still got a long ways to go. So
So you're not going to be satisfied with being in 35,000 retailers and having millions of customers.
Right. So that's really what kept me going through the whole thing was because there were so many stumbling blocks that came up when EPA came to me and said, hey, this is a pesticide. You can't sell this without a federal license. And I said, what? What are you talking about? It's just corn cob chips and essential oils from a balsam fir tree. This is like not toxic. What do you mean? And they said, well, it's probably going to take you about $2 million. It's going to take years, and it's probably never going to happen because it's the equivalent of registering a herbal tincture as an FDA medicine. Ooh. It's the same kind of thing. And that's when I was like, I got to start praying about this. I got to take this to a whole new level. And I was able to get some grants to help. I did a lot of the research myself. I worked with the ag department and universities. I learned to get as resourceful as I could to get over every single obstacle that came my way. And we eventually did get it EPA registered. And so it was the first product to get that, and it still is the only federal EPA-registered botanical repellent on the market.
Why did you want it to be environmentally friendly? Like you said, 90, 98% of this market is poisons.
Yeah, well, I was looking at it from a mom. I had kids, I had pets. I love the wildlife. I'm a huge nature lover. Some people call me a tree hugger. I just really love nature, and I'm thinking, I really don't want to put something in there that has a risk of poisoning my kids and my pets. And I thought other people would feel the same way. And it turns out about 61% of the people out there that buy pest control want something that's non-toxic.
So how are they working then? Will some corn cobs and some essential oils kill a spider or a beetle or whatever it is that they're going after, or just keep them from getting in the human space? How does that work?
So it's a combination of behavior and ingredients, really. And each pest is different. For a rodent, for instance, what I discovered is rodents can't see very far, and I was wondering why they were running around and look like they're all haphazard, right? And so I knew they couldn't see very well, but they had a highly evolved sense of smell. And so it became, well, I can't really lure them in with something and kill them. I can't plug in an ultrasonic thing in my tractor cab because there's no electricity in there. So it's like, how do I keep them out from the start? And so I looked to nature, and I looked at balsam fir trees. Well, in the forest, it gets cold, and it snows during the winter. And the rodents, when there's no food, they'll chew on the bark. So the trees make their own pesticides. Basically, it's like a sap that drips down and makes the tree unpalatable to a mouse, to the wild mice. So that's how it came to get balsam fir oil in the product. So it's a natural pesticide. And we've had probably four or five other neighbors, I call them, rather than competitors out in the marketplace. And they're using mints and they're using other things, and they can freeze. It isn't the same approach as what we do, where it's a holistic look. I'll look at nature and see what makes sense. So for spiders, for instance, which is our second best-selling product, it's called Stay Away Spiders. And it's just an absolute hit. And so what that product does is it repels the bugs that spiders eat. So what I noticed with the spiders, I studied them for a long time. I actually got bit twice by brown recluse spiders because I was so freaked out about them, I did not want to go into it. And people were asking me for a spider repellent. I said, no, that's not what we do. You got to remember, I grew up with an entomologist father, so we had bugs all over, and he had a spider collection, and, you know, I should be, like, sensitized to them, but I'm not. They still freak me out. So
third most common fear here. You're in good company.
It really is. And so I was just like, well, we got to keep them out. And then I found out how many car accidents happen from spiders. And I found out spiders are in pretty much every home across the country, and they're all over the world. And they don't, 99% of them aren't going to cause any harm or hurt you, and they want to stay out of the way. But still, with that said, they cause webs, and they can make a mess. Well, people right now, currently, they'll kill them, they'll spray them, and then another one moves in because there's still food. So I thought, well, let's remove the food source. And then you don't have to deal with the spiders, and you don't have to deal with the webs.
You know, a minute ago, you used the word holistic when you were talking about your products and how they compare to what else is on the market. And I'm really interested in that word. On your website, you're not talking exclusively about how to repel these bugs, how to keep them out of your home. There are also articles about spiders and the good that spiders do.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing that most people aren't thinking about in pest control, and when they pick up something to, like, kill it, right? There's always a reason that it's in there. And there's a natural ecosystem, well, in all of life. If you change one thing, it impacts another. So I'm a huge, I say CEO as chief ecology officer, because I think of myself much like that. Even building a business, being an entrepreneur, you need an ecosystem that supports you to grow that business. Well, I look at pest control as the same thing. So part of our delivery of our products is to educate consumers. And that's basically how we've grown. We bootstrapped the business from the very, very beginning. Using the internet. So somebody types in, I have a pest, I don't want to use a poison, what do I do? They'd find us. And then we'd serve them up information of how to get rid of that pest. Like spiders, for instance, don't like vibration. So you can turn on a radio really loud, leave for the weekend. It's going to drive them out.
So all the times I was driving my mom crazy as a teenager listening to Nirvana, I was just helping the spiders.
So there's a lot of things like that homeowners can do that make their environment less desirable to a pest. And you got to think, too, the effects of poisons, too, on the home, there's risk to that. And they really, I don't believe that they should be used without somebody with a pesticide license. So we often refer people to their professional pest control operators because it can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of accidents that happen by people using them incorrectly.
Sure. You mentioned the word ecosystem when it comes to the business climate and that phrase feeling supported. And a lot of times we think it's pretty lonely at the top and that you don't get to the top of your field by making a lot of friends along the way. And especially in a female-owned business, what is sort of your philosophy on supporting other, especially female business owners, and did you feel supported along your journey?
I did feel supported. It's a special thing being from North Dakota, and a lot of people aren't really aware of this, but North Dakota has the best climate in the country for entrepreneurship. We've also seen an increase of over 5,000 businesses, about 33% growth since like 2007. And this is – women owned are creating most of these jobs, and we're creating more revenue from these jobs. And our business center here in the state was like named the national best center in the whole country. So – they're doing some amazing things here that are a little bit different, and I was the benefit of that. So for instance, I went to SBA back in the early years to learn how to do my books and set up the accounting, which is a really critical component because you got to know if you're going to make money, right?
Mm-hmm.
I learned about business planning there. I was a member of the Pride of Dakota, which is the North Dakota Ag Department. So I learned how to actually package my products and sell them at the Pride of Dakota shows. It was hugely valuable. Other states don't have programs like this. I was a member of the National Women's Business Council. And what that is we're an advisory group to the Senate, the White House, and SBA on matters of importance to women in business. So it was fantastic to take all that I'd learned in my, you know, past 10 years growing and scaling a business and apply that on the policy side to come up with policy that's really supportive of women in business. And entrepreneurship right now is at an all-time low. And I just saw the latest research from Kauffman Foundation. The fact of it is 66% of millennials want to be an entrepreneur. They're entrepreneurial tendencies, but only 5% are actually doing it. So there's barriers in the way, and there's policy to change.
Do you see those barriers? Is it an access thing, education, policy, some of each?
So what the research is showing is that the college loans, we're at an all-time high for student loan debt. And we're at an all-time low for retirement accounts, which starting a business a lot of times will come out of a retirement account. In the U.S. today, it costs an average of $30,000 to open your doors, hang a shingle, start a business, and it takes about 5 days to get it set up. Now, what changes, that's starting a business. But to grow and scale a business and really create jobs like I'm doing with Earthkind, less than 1% of entrepreneurs actually make it over $5 million in revenues. And then when they get there, what happens is a lot of times they'll sell out. So these small businesses that create the jobs, what's happening, especially with women, because it's even more, much more of a disparity there, you get this what's called a missing middle. And the entrepreneurs just drop out at that point. So there's some organizations out there, big businesses helping that missing middle grow and scale and create jobs rather than selling out, because that's where the best innovations come from. And women-owned businesses are highly profitable. Who's the guy from Shark Tank? But he said, I love women in business, and they're not very cowboyish. You know, they give better returns and – the facts are in on that. So capital groups are starting to look too at investing.
What would you say that women bring to the business field? So often we think of winners, and I'm using that word in air quotes, in business as male, as, you know, this hyper-masculine atmosphere. What do you think women are bringing to that market?
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, I'm a member of EY Entrepreneurial Winning Women, class of 2012. There's a little over 50 of us now across the nation, and we're all entrepreneurs that have grown companies and scaling them in that mid-market range. We all had an innovative idea, took it to market, changed a market, and we're growing. And I remember when I first joined the class and I walked in and I saw these ladies around. I'm like, I'm the oldest one here. I just know it. And I was thinking, I'm so introverted. I just don't fit here. How, you know, every reason why I shouldn't be there. And here I am years later with these women. And I've watched them grow their businesses to 100 million or even a billion. And they all had exactly the same thoughts on their mind. Mm. I'm too old. I'm not smart enough. I, you know, don't have the money. So we all have that voice going on in our head. It doesn't matter who it is. And so it's often it's like a fallacy, right? People think, well, I shouldn't be an entrepreneur. I don't know enough. The fact of the matter is the best entrepreneurs are the ones that they just get up every day, put their shoes on and say, I'm going to figure this out. I'm just going to keep going and I'm going to learn what I need to learn and do what I need to do. Now, having a network is extremely important because when you get to a certain size or even when you're starting, you really need that support system around you because oftentimes your family doesn't know how to answer those questions, right?
Right.
How
yeah.
do I do this?
I don't know.
And the larger your business gets, the smaller that pool of who to ask gets. And in my early years, I remember I can't even tell you how many hundreds of thousands I've wasted on consultants and this and people who said, well, I know better, and you trust them. And the fact of the matter is you just make it up as you go and you use your gut and you use your heart and you just hope that you make more good decisions than bad decisions and that you treat people really well.
Carrie, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Carrie Warburg-Block. She is the founder of Earthkind, a company that sells natural products for pest control. You can find out more at earthkind.com. Carrie has a few recommendations for current and future business owners. She herself worked with the National Women's Business Council to make a resource platform, and you can find that at nwbc.gov. It helps people come up with business plans and more. She also recommends the sba.gov website. Now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. DFL State Representative Paul Marquardt of Dilworth says school security is the number one priority for legislators, and he fully supports Governor Mark Dayton's plan to use $21 million to improve safety and mental health services at Minnesota schools.
You know, the thing to remember is that the schools in our area are safe. You know, let's not lose sight of that. But, you know, in this day and age, we need to do everything we can to make sure that our facilities are as safe and secure as possible, but that we're also dealing and identifying those students with mental health issues.
DFL State Representative Ben Lean of Moorhead says administrators and teachers told him there are new challenges in the classroom that were not there for us seen 5 or 10 years. And providing resources to protect schools is necessary.
The Moorhead School District would see about $135,000 in new funding that would be that the district could use toward more safe schools, things like more secured entrances, bulletproof glass around school districts if that's necessary. We need to do everything that we can to keep our schools safe.
Governor Dayton's Safe and Secure Schools Act would use $21 million of the state's projected $329 million surplus for schools next year for safety improvements and to identify and help students at risk of becoming violent. The Grand Forks County jail is running out of room. The inmate population climbed again in 2017 to an average of over 211 prisoners per day. That compares to 198 in 2016 and 193 in 2015. Jail Administrator Brett Burkholder says consultants suggest anything above the 180 mark exceeds functional capacity.
We have no infirmary beds specifically. We don't have single cells for those who are mentally ill. And more of our population tends to have needs of those beds. When we have someone that has a need for that bed, one person takes up two beds because there's two beds in every cell. So we lose a lot of beds that way.
Burkholder says the consultants are working on plans ranging from a do-nothing approach to a jail expansion.
Building is a single-time cost. It might be over 20 years or something, but operations continues every day. So anything that is done has to really be looked at for operational costs as much or even more so than the building, because operations can kill you more than the building itself.
Housing local prisoners also means the potential loss of federal inmates, which generate income for the jail. Burkholder says the role local jails play in within the state system may be a conversation during the 2019 legislative session.
And I'm happy to say that my first official report as director of OMB contains good news that basically we are continuing to track very closely to our legislative forecast.
Joe Morissette is the new director of the state's Office of Management and Budget. He's been on the job since March 1st, and he presented a general fund status report to the legislature's Interim Government Finance Committee. Morissette told the committee the state is on track to finish the upcoming biennium with $112 million in the bank.
And of course, based on current law, $65 million is the amount of that that would stay in the general fund and be carried over to start the next biennium, and about $47 million would go into the Budget Stabilization Fund.
The 2017 legislature virtually drained the Budget Stabilization Fund to help balance the budget. Morissette says so far revenues are about 1.7% ahead of forecast, or about $27 million over the last forecast. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The White House is laying out ideas to revive rural areas where the president received 60% of the vote in the 2016 election. But as Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains, people who work on that issue aren't sure the administration is fully invested.
Here's something rural advocates took as a sign the White House is in tune with their interests. Remember the administration's $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan? It includes a special carve-out for rural areas. President Trump set out the basics in a meeting with state and local officials.
It provides $50 billion for rural infrastructure, who have really been left out. The rural folks have been left out.
According to the plan, most of the money would be given to the states based on population and the length of country roads. It doesn't mention unemployment rates or economic output. Trump said the goal is to spark job growth by building new roads and upgrading utilities,
including broadband internet access, which they don't have, and they want it.
Actually, about 60% of rural residents do have access to high-speed internet, but Maurice Jones says the administration is on track here. Jones is CEO of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, which helps plan and finance rural projects across the country. He says broadband is sort of a basic need to help provide online classes and job training to prepare rural workers for jobs he says are in demand.
We're talking welders and electricians, coding and medical technicians. If you have the talent that's prepared for the jobs will come.
But there are other proposals from the administration that give rural advocates like Jones pause. One of them is the president's budget. The Trump administration wants to cut $100 million from programs in the USDA's Rural Business Cooperative Service. It awards grants and loans often to small and specialized businesses that don't qualify for commercial financing. Companies like 24-Hour Tees in Kearney, a city of about 30,000 in central Nebraska.
I wanted to do it in glitter. Do you have different colors of glitter?
Yes.
About 5 years ago, Shauna and Chase Meyer started making one-of-a-kind shirts on demand at a downtown storefront. A wall of shirts shows off their designs.
You've got to be kidding me. Just people come in and they want their friend's face huge printed on a T-shirt just as a practical joke.
Shauna says after 3 years, they'd outgrown their one-at-a-time printer. They were contracting other shops to print their big orders. To buy equipment, they would need a loan. Chase says they went to 7 banks over 6 months. They all said no, not enough collateral.
They don't know what to do with a $30,000 screen print machine if we were to default on a loan. It was like, We don't want to hassle with it. We don't want the headaches.
The money eventually came from a USDA program that in 2016 awarded $19 million in loans and is one of the programs the White House suggests cutting. A year ago, the Myers got their $60,000 loan and opened a new workshop in a warehouse connected to a laundromat.
So all right. This is the place?
This is our silkscreen shop. Yep.
Instead of a couple dozen shirts, Chase says the typical order is now 100 at a time, printed on big spider-shaped machines. He says it may be an unconventional rural business, but it's supporting itself.
It would be a huge disservice to businesses like us to not even have that as an option.
Congress could keep the loan programs funded, since White House budgets are largely for show. But the proposed cuts could find their way into the Farm Bill, which is up for reauthorization. Jonathan Hladek, a policy analyst at the Center for Rural Affairs, thinks the administration mostly says the right things, but he's concerned it might just be lip service.
We have a sense of what they're watching and paying attention to, but we don't necessarily know, you know, which specific policies are we going to champion.
Less than a tenth of 1% of the last Farm Bill was aimed at rural development. But with uncertainty about the administration's commitment to fund those programs, he says he'd accept the status quo. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris, in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Up next on Main Street, the legacy of historian Elwin Robinson.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. Comic books are much more than the silly distraction they're often thought to be. They are, in fact, a literary genre at the height of its maturity and sophistication, and they're only getting better. On our next episode, we're going to ask how and why this is, and explore how to recognize them for the art they are. So join me and Scott McCloud for How to Read a Comic Book on the next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The name Elwin Robinson is well known in certain circles. The late historian taught at the University of North Dakota and wrote The History of North Dakota. That book became something of a classic for books about state histories. His life's work is part of a new digital exhibit from UND. Historian Tom Ezern teaches at North Dakota State University, and he spoke with Doug Hamilton about Robinson's legacy.
Tom, thanks for being with us.
Wait a minute. We get to talk about history today?
Yeah, we are.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, we all get to live history. I'm sort of still doing mine. I'm processing it. You know, I think back 50 years and how I've changed and all that kind of stuff. So let's talk about the discipline itself first. What is history to a historian?
Well, I always make the distinction with my students. There's history with a capital H and history with a small h. Small h, that's everything that's happened in the past. Capital H, that's what we make of it.
Okay. So there's the objective and the subjective, and we try to make some synthesis out of that by taking facts and putting them in whatever order seems appropriate. So let's talk about Elwin Robinson. Who was he and why is he important to North Dakota?
I think you'd have to consider Elwin Robinson in some intellectual way, the founding father. Can you still say that? Okay. Yeah. Well, we're talking about 1950, the founding father of North Dakota history. He taught it from 1950 for a low, three decades at the University of North Dakota, and then wrote the landmark signature History of North Dakota, published in 1966.
So what were his principal pieces of historical note that we remember from what he wrote and what we may reinterpret now?
Well, he's mainly known for the six themes of North Dakota history that he laid out first in an anniversary address, 75th anniversary address at UND, and then they are incorporated into his big history published in 1966, the six themes of North Dakota history. And in fact, you know, that history was regarded at the time in the 1960s as the model state history in the United States. Okay, Elwin Robinson got it right. The professional historians of the country would agree as to how to do a state history.
And for his time, he, as you said, he's a model, but history has a way of kind of evolving.
Yeah, sure. To have six themes, which really are what historians would call causes. You know, these are the things that drive North Dakota history. He had six of them. Okay, that's a little complicated. That's multiple causation history, as compared to some historians who may get on one horse and ride it to death. They're economic determinists or environmental determinists or whatever, or Marxist. You know, they got one tool in the toolkit. He has multiple causes. Now, where things have moved today is to look back on that and say, yeah, but you can't just take six causes and add them together and that's your history, that there's a complexity in the process to account for also.
Well, let's look at those six pieces, those six themes, because you can Google Elwin Robinson. There's a wealth of information there, Bing or Yahoo, whatever search engine you want to use. That first one was remoteness,
yep.
And that certainly fit the state at that time.
Yes, indeed. A long way from anything, mm-hmm. long way from particularly from the centers of power, both economic and political.
Dependence. And, of course, North Dakota or Dakota Territory was a big chunk of Minnesota for a while.
Yeah. So we send our wheat down to the mills in the Twin Cities. We send our insurance premium somewhere back east. And we depend on manufacturers elsewhere to supply our quality of life. We're dependent upon powers elsewhere.
And we're still a commodity state.
Yeah.
Largely.
Yeah.
Radicalism. This one, I think, bears a little more discussion because the state has a very interesting political history,
sure.
particularly with that State Bank of North Dakota, the State Mill and Elevator, the Wobblies back in the World War I era. The state is interesting when it comes to radicalism.
Yeah. He's thinking particularly, no doubt, of the Nonpartisan League.
Yeah.
Now, Elwin Robinson may be in his own personal beliefs a little bit left of center. Okay, he's a Democrat, and I suppose that's where he puts him in North Dakota, right? But I don't know that he's considering radicalism to be a positive adjective because none of his themes, in fact, are positive optimistic developments.
Well, then economic disadvantage is his fourth.
We have a hard time competing in manufacturing. Related to remoteness, we're a long way from markets. We don't have centers of capital. Yeah,
and then we get to number five,
oh.
The too much mistake.
The most famous of them all. Yeah.
Well, expand on that for our listeners.
Well, all along the railroads built across the state, every 8 miles there's a town. Do we need all those towns? Do we need all those hardware stores? Do we need 10 bars in this town? Do we need all these schools?
Do we need all these people?
Well, you see, it eventually comes to that. How
yeah.
many people do you need in North Dakota? And he was saying that the state over-projected, let's say, particularly during the second Dakota boom of the early 1900s.
Sounds a little bit like Buffalo Commons talk back about 30 or so years ago.
Well, his message was tighten your belts. You know, we haven't yet adjusted to the too much mistake in the 1960s, he would say.
Number six, the sixth of those six themes of North Dakota history, adjustment to the imperatives of a cool subhuman grassland, meaning that life in the state changed to
yeah.
accommodate its physical yeah. environment.
All Western American historians were cognizant of the work of Walter Prescott Webb, The Great Plains, 1931. Environment rules. Environment determines culture.
So he was an influential historian for his time.
Exceedingly, when you consider that the main J school that is training journalists in North Dakota, University of North Dakota, mm-hmm. The law school, the med school, influential people and shapers of opinion likely took North Dakota history with Elwin Robinson. And they got the best state history you could have gotten in the United States, probably.
Did his interpretation of history have unintended consequences?
Are you setting me up here now?
Come on.
You threw me a big one right over the plate.
Yeah.
Right? You know, one of those pages that you can look to find out about Elwin Robinson themes, I put it out there. You know, I teach this stuff. But I teach it in the same way that I teach Walter Prescott Webb's The Great Plains. We need to know how people on the prairies thought about this place in past generations. And so Elwin Robinson is state of the art in the 1960s. This is how we thought about ourselves. And it's good. It's really good. Any point of view, if you start to fossilize it and project it forward without context, then can become a stumbling block. And people in anywhere from small town community activities right into our legislature, we tend to define leadership as those who are best at belt tightening and are skeptical of positivist proposals to do great things.
Well, when Elwin Robinson arrived in North Dakota, it was probably starting its population decline, wasn't it?
Yes. And of course, we're coming off a whole generation of resource starvation owing to the Great Depression and the World War when, well, we can't do that. There's a war on. And then after that, what slaps us on the other cheek here in North Dakota, it's not exactly that population decline was going on in the 1950s, let's say, because small towns all over the place are building swimming pools and schools and that sort of thing because people had a lot of kids. Veterans came home, kids everywhere.
And you had a GI Bill. We were filling the universities too.
Yeah. So things are rolling along pretty well, but the demographics are against us because the kids are leaving. You know, they finish up school and they depart. And that prevails certainly through the 1980s. And into the 1990s a bit.
And you've got the railroads deciding we don't have to have a stop every 8 miles and the elevator companies deciding we can centralize bigger elevators elsewhere. These towns kind of get frozen out.
And Class B schools with three hyphens in the names of them.
Yeah, that's the consolidation effect. And, of course, the farms. Those smaller farms became much bigger farms.
Yeah. All over the Great Plains. So, you know, my brother and I own the farm back home. But how many farms aren't there because we absorbed them?
Well, don't want to blame too much on a historian because obviously these things were happening. He was recording them as they were happening. But does the idea that you've got these six themes of North Dakota and one being that we've overbuilt and the other that we're in a tough place, we're between a rock and a hard place in terms of the United States, sort of make people think, well, you know, especially young people, maybe I should find my future someplace else.
Hey, if I took North Dakota history and was taught these six themes and I'm thinking about what to do with my life, I think I might try to find a better place to fulfill my aspirations.
Well, he's been gone a while now, and it's still a very important book. And the whole book is available online. That's a wonderful gift to the state of North Dakota, all the people. But how has the interpretation of our state's history changed since he wrote that book?
North Dakota has had a bit of a problem in terms of development of historical thought. Until recently, there were no PhD programs in history in North Dakota. There was no university press in North Dakota. And so if you compare that with a place like Oklahoma or Nebraska, admittedly, they've got a greater population resource base. But nevertheless, you could have smaller versions of the same things, but we didn't in North Dakota. And so perhaps that's why Elwin Robinson's thought stands sort of pristine, and we still speak in those terms without alternative interpretations. Now, we have to do like a whole week's programs if you want my alternative interpretations of North Dakota.
Well, tease us with what that might be.
Well, I think it hinges on the idea of agency. Mm-hmm. Broad impersonal causes like environment aren't history. They are the setting of history. And how people respond to those is what makes history.
Yeah.
And so faced with certain circumstances, there are always choices. Now, it may be that all those choices stink, but still making the choice is what makes history. And we have to reckon with the possibility that in the 21st century, there might be choices present that weren't present in 1966.
Well, the reason that we brought you in here to have this discussion is because Elwin Robinson is in the news recently. The University of North Dakota has this new multimedia interactive exhibit celebrating his book, History of North Dakota. And it's a kiosk and you can sort of play with images and text and things like that. And this is kind of a new way of looking at history too, isn't it? It's a new tool and may encourage people to think more critically.
Well, they're having in mind that people might respond to these venerable doctrines that come down from Elwin Robinson.
Well, but this is a way to take it out of the archive in a sense and make it more accessible.
Yeah.
I mean, is this something that you expect to see more broadly? We do see these kind of interactive things, for example, at the North Dakota State Historical Center.
Sure. Well, it is, as long as it's not without context, it's like the Ten Commandments or Holy Writ, the same yesterday, today, and forever.
Or some amendments we could talk about,
But I greatly encourage studying Elwin Robinson and his works for what they tell us about the development of North Dakota. I hope that our future legislators and future newspaper editors and so on also are alive to other possibilities.
So do historians ever play what if?
Yeah, we make fun of it all the time and then do it.
Well, what if Elwin Robinson were alive today?
Oh, you want me to channel him a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he would want to be speaking to affairs as they are. I think that he would be – well, in fact, I think he would be aware of some of the same historical currents that I am, the rise of agency as a doctrine and contingency and those kind of things in governing how historians think and open up possibilities and aspirations rather than determinisms. But I can't say just what Elwin Robinson would think. But what I think is he was utterly current and state-of-the-art in his time in the 1960s. I think he would be utterly current and state-of-the-art in the 21st century.
I was intrigued when I was doing my little bit of research, my little bit of reading about him, that back in the late 40s, he put together all these radio, quarter-hour radio shows about the heroes of North Dakota.
Yeah, you know, like I do here at Prairie Public.
Yes.
He was doing that in the late 1940s. He's ahead of his time in many ways.
Have you heard any of these?
I haven't. But, you know, now that I've looked back over this stuff, I really want to hear them.
Well, he recorded them in the Grand Forks radio station, KFJM. We now have those call letters, so I look forward to digging through our archives, finding out where they are, and maybe we'll put a couple on the air.
I want to hear them if you dig them up. You bet.
Well, Heroes of North Dakota was broadcast in lots of communities across the state, and of course, we have our Plains Folk essays from our very own Tom Easer in these days. But it's just a reminder that history isn't necessarily cast in bronze.
Yeah, and even if it's cast in bronze, people tear down monuments.
Yeah, they do. Thank you, Tom Easer.
Oh, my pleasure, Doug. Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
Parents, students, decision makers, everybody's a stakeholder in the success of education in North Dakota. And that is why Prairie Public Education Services has teamed up with North Dakota United, the North Dakota Department for Public Instruction, and innovation expert Ted Dintersmith for the weekly Cutting Ed podcast. Hosted by Tom Gerhart, The Cutting Ed explores education innovations in our state. You can find The Cutting Ed wherever you get your podcasts or at ndunited.org/thecuttinged.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 7th. On this date in 1917, the Washburn Leader newspaper announced the death of Judge Walter H. Winchester. He retired from the bench in 1912. His health began to deteriorate following his retirement. He developed a brain hemorrhage after an operation on March 4th and passed away shortly thereafter. He was survived by his wife, two daughters, and a son. Winchester was born in Malone, New York, in 1844. He went to school there, and after graduating from Franklin County Academy, he spent 2 years at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He served in the Army during the Civil War. In 1870, Winchester traveled to Iowa. For 6 months, he worked as a reporter for the Davenport Democrat and Leader newspaper. He then relocated to Cordova, Illinois, where he took a position as principal of the Cordova Academy. After 1 year there, Winchester returned to New York, where he served as principal of Fort Covington Academy for 3 years while studying law. He graduated from Albany University in 1873 and was admitted to the bar. He practiced law in New York until he finally moved to Bismarck in 1883. In North Dakota, Winchester quickly earned a reputation as an able attorney, but he also served as the Burleigh County Superintendent of Schools. Winchester was elected as the judge of the 6th Judicial Court in 1889 and served in that position until 1912. As a Civil War veteran, he was a member of the local post of the Grand Army of the Republic. On Memorial Day in 1912, he gave a stirring rendition of the Gettysburg Address. He was active in the Masonic Lodge, and when he passed away, the Masons honored him with a Masonic funeral. He was described as the best-known judge in North Dakota. Because of his dedicated work with schools, Winchester's family instituted the Winchester Prize in his honor in 1913. The prize was awarded annually in the Bismarck School District for proficiency in arithmetic. The winning student received $25. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Earl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Think your family is crazy? Dakota Stage presents Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike March 15th through the 17th and the 22nd through the 25th at Dakota Stage in Bismarck. This hilarious Tony Award-winning comedy follows siblings Vanya and Sonia, whose world is turned upside down by a visit from their used-to-be-famous sister, Masha, and her latest boy toy, Spike. Tickets and more information can be found online at dakotastageltd.com or by calling 701-258-4998.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
A Michigan factory makes industrial blades from unique foreign steel not made in the United States. Workers there worry about a possible steel tariff.
This plant could shut down, and all 80 employees here, a lot of very good people, could lose their jobs.
Side effects of President Trump's proposed tariffs on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to think about the question, what role does a library play in capturing history? Mark Holman is the library director at Sitting Bull College on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, which was the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline protest, which captured international attention in 2017. And we are going to hear about that from a librarian's perspective. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.